You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 10th, 2014, Ron Coddington presented the fourth lecture in our five-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. Images of African Americans who fought in the American Civil War are very rare. In this podcast, Mr. Coddington talks about some of those men whose portraits he documented in his book, African American Faces of the Civil War, an album. Ron Coddington is the assistant manager at Chronicle of Higher Education, whose work has appeared in USA Today, the Atlantic Journal-Constitution, and the San Jose Mercury News. Mr. Coddington is a contributing writer to the New York Times Disunion series and writes a monthly column for the Civil War News. In addition to African American Faces of the Civil War, Mr. Coddington has written two other books, Faces of the Confederacy, an album of Southern soldiers and their stories, and Faces of the Civil War, an album of Union soldiers and their stories. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses, African American Faces of the Civil War. Here's Ron Coddington.
Thank you all. First off, thank you so much for giving up a wonderful spring day to come inside and listen to some talk about the Civil War. Also, Rick, thank you so much for making this possible, and also for being the point person on the slideshow. There's some pressure for Rick right now, so we got a lot of slides to go through.
And a lot of buttons.
Yeah. So I want to start by taking you back not too far to 2008 when I began a journey. And that journey was to find Civil War photographs, original wartime images of African American soldiers. There are, as you may know, 200,000 men of color that served in the military, that's the Army and the Navy, from roughly 1863 to 1865 and beyond. And the stories of these men and their photographs are an amazing part of the record of our country. Interestingly, you rarely see photographs of African American men in your textbooks and other storybooks. The same photographs, and this is not a slight to any of the authors out there, but you see the same photographs over and over again. It's a company of men that were at a fort in Washington, D.C. They're great photographs, but I also know that there's more. So I set out to find these photographs, and so I also found along the way some wonderful stories. And I thought I would start by introducing you to one of these men and telling you a little bit about his story. This is William Dominic Matthews, and he's from Maryland. He was a very important part of the Civil War. He's also a name that you've probably never heard before. And in the course of his career, and then afterwards, he told his story many, many times. And several of those interviews appeared in newspapers after the war, and I was fortunate enough to find some of those interviews. So in his own words, I'm going to run through some slides and a little bit about him. So it starts, actually, if you can go to the next frame. He says, I was born on the eastern shore of Maryland. My father, Joseph Matthews, was a full-blooded African, and my mother was the half-white daughter of a Frenchman. I never went to school one day in my life, for so strict were the laws in Maryland against educating colored people that it was dangerous to be seen with a book. I left the Eastern Shore at 21 years, and going to Baltimore, shipped and followed the sea till 1854. When I returned to Baltimore, bought a vessel and cruised the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay till a law was passed forbidding a colored man to be captain of his vessel. I was therefore forced to sell mine almost for nothing. So he's been through this event in his life, and he's a native Marylander, decides that he's not going to hang out in that state anymore. So a number of men faced with similar circumstances might have decided to head north, maybe to Boston or somewhere, maybe to Canada, somewhere where it was safer and opportunities were perhaps better. Not William Dominic Matthews. If you hit the next slide, we'll see where he goes. He decides in 1856 to go to Kansas, which at the time is known as Bloody Kansas, where you've got the free the battle for free or slave state happening. He goes there, and here's what he says. I started for Kansas in 1856 and found a great fight for freedom and progress. In Leavenworth, I opened a large eating house where I was patronized by most of the wealthy whites of the town. Next. While I entertained them in the front of my house, my back door was always ajar for the fleeing traveler on the Underground Railroad, which had one of its terminals at my house. So you don't find out about this until now, but he's a freedom fighter. He's gone to the middle, to the danger zone, to ground zero to help his fellow men of color. Next, please. In connection with John Brown and other anti-slavery men, I succeeded in baffling the pursuers. Next. With the assistance of Colonel D.R. Anthony, brother of Miss Susan B. Anthony, and other true and tried white men, I have more than once resisted the slave hunters who were backed up by the U.S. Marshals. Keeping in mind, it's a federal offense at this point. Next, please. In 1861, I gave up my white boarders and turned my house into a home for slaves. At this time, I organized a company of 100 men and stood guard night and day, protecting the slaves as they came to Kansas from their masters. I also offered my services with my company of 100 men to the government to aid in the war, but was told it was a white man's war and we were not wanted. Not uncommon. This was happening throughout the free northern states and some of the border states at the time. So, next. So here he is, Matthews. He's had his troubles in Maryland. He's come to Kansas. He's fought a good fight. He's ready to fight in the Civil War. He's not allowed to. Again, most men would probably maybe throw in the towel, but not Matthews. He knew that there was a larger fight for freedom and progress. He was not ready to quit. So in 1861 and 1862, as the War Department is beginning to rethink their policy and as the Lincoln administration is beginning to deal with this influx of slaves that are coming in, being labeled as contraband material and other names, flooding in from cities and towns from around the South as the Union armies move in, what are we going to do with all of these men? Well, there's another opportunity, and that's to put them in the army. So Matthews, in 1862, as the laws are beginning to change, and you see these, you see Matthews in Kansas, he's raising another 200 men to fight. That's two companies, and two companies in a regiment of 1,000 men, that's a lot of guys. So he goes ahead and he raises all of these men. Meanwhile, in South Carolina and Massachusetts, it's also happening in Louisiana, in different pockets around the country, this is happening. He's one of the leaders out in Kansas. So on January 1st, 1863, Emancipation Day, he and his men and the entire 1,000 men of the regiment are in camp, Fort Scott, out in Kansas. It's sort of a balmy day. Sun is trying to poke out, but not really getting there. But it's not dampening the spirits of anybody. There's three American flags that are flying over the camp. Those flags were made by the wives of the men of color who are now wearing their blue uniforms for the first time. There's music There's dancing, there's cake, there's coffee, there's pies, there's a lot of barbecue. We're having a great time. This is all documented in an absolutely wonderful newspaper article. And of course, they're talking about this is going to be a barbecue in the old Southern style, and that means a lot of speech making after everyone's had plenty to eat and drink. So the white officers, the politicians in town, everybody has a shot at saying a few words. But there's one man that everybody wants to hear from, and that's him. He's considered the heart and the soul of the regiment, not only for all the men that he's raised, but for all of the lives that he's touched, helping men, women, and children come to freedom. So in that same article is a little bit about the speech that he made. And he starts out by saying this. He's now standing in the camp. You've got all the tables behind him. All the men have now stood in their ranks. The white officers are all around him. And he says, "Today is a day for great rejoicing with us. It's Emancipation Day. The president has proclaimed freedom. The Southern Loyalists," that's him, "the Southern Loyalists hear and intend to take it. I'm not surprised while I rejoice. As a thinking man, I never doubted this day would come, for I believed in God. It was a crime to hold and a sin to be a slave." Next. Matthews goes on for quite some time, and he ends with these words. And now he's talking directly to the men in the ranks. He says, "Let me speak a word to my people. Now is our time to strike. Our own exertions and our own muscle must make us men. If we fight, we shall be respected." And in fact, these guys did fight. They fought at a little place called Island Mound in October of 1862. It was in Missouri. 2 months, 3 months before they had their Emancipation Day celebration, they fought a couple hundred Confederates that were marauding around that area. It's the first time that African Americans in uniform were in combat in the Army of the United States during the Civil War. Just to give you a little bit of perspective, those of you that know the movie Glory and the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, they fought at Fort Wagner, July 18, 1863. These guys were fighting 9 months before Fort Wagner. So they were way out in front in many ways. And again, Matthews has played a really important role. And if you think that Matthews is unusual because of his persistence, because of his determination, because of his will, the thing that we, as Americans, we all hold those values dear, he's not really alone. As I was researching these men over and over and over again, you see these themes echoed. Let's go to the next slide, Rick. You have men like Alexander Heritage Newton. What a great name. He's standing on the left, and he says, "I had no ill feeling for the Southern white people." He's from North Carolina, by the way. "I have no ill feeling for the Southern white people. Some of them have been my best friends. But this was not a personal matter, but a question of national issue involving the welfare of millions. And my soul was on fire for the question, slavery or no slavery, to be forever settled, and that too as soon as possible." Next. We have Martin Delaney, a name that may be known to some of you, very prominent before the war. He became the first Army staff officer, a major, in 1865 as the war was winding down. Martin Delaney, it was said by a biographer, that the war had become inseparable from his daily existence and nothing would content him but entering the service. He cared not how, provided his admission recognized the rights of his race to do so. And then the next, we've got James Matthew Townsend, a regular guy, somehow got to Ohio, a free man. A biographer said of him, "At the beginning of the rebellion, he had a strong conviction that the war would result in the emancipation of his race." So these feelings, these emotions, this dedication to duty, this recognition and realization that this was the time, had come to take charge. Over and over again, you see it through the eyes and by the words of these men. So, I'm going to hold here for a second and go, I'm sorry, we're going to leave you hanging for a second on this story, but we're going to go on. Okay. So, the origin of this book really goes back to my first book, and that was in 2004. I was a rookie author. I can even tell you about the moment here. I'm a rookie author. I'm at my very first book signing. I've got my pen ready to do all that author stuff. It felt good, I have to admit. So I'm in Baltimore at a festival. It's an outdoor festival. Bit of a rainy day, but we have a big crowd, and a number of people are coming up to the tents. It's a very nice festival. And a woman comes up to the Johns Hopkins University press tent. I'm sitting there. Hello, how are you today? We're talking. She picks up the book, this book, and she carefully begins going through it almost page by page. And I'm thinking, I guess she really likes it. She's kind of reading it right in front of me. So some time goes by, and I'm not exaggerating. She spends a lot of time with this book. And she finishes, she closes it, and she hands it back to me. And she looks at me in the eyes, and she says, you know, there are men of color who also served in the Army. Now, it didn't matter to her that in the introduction to the book, I explained how difficult it was, almost impossible, to find images of African Americans, how I never saw them come up for sale in flea markets or garage sales or antique shows. I've been a longtime collector of these photographs. You don't see them in books. You rarely see them in museums. And even then, most of them are not identified. That made me feel good to write it. But for her, it didn't matter. So I knew then and there that someday I was going to do this book. I don't know who she is. I'm assuming she lives somewhere in Baltimore. But during the most difficult times when I was ready to give up on this project, and granted, there was a lot of times because the images were so hard to come by, I would see her face, her looking at me and handing the book back. And so I thought, this one, this is for her. She kept me, she was my angel that kept me going. So, next please. So, as I mentioned, I've been collecting these photographs since I was, I was 14 when I started. I've always been quite interested in the visual power of imagery, not only from the Civil War, but from all times in history, whether it's photographs or paintings. But my interest in history combined with photography really is powerful. And when you can see an individual's face, to look in their eyes, to get a sense of what they were like, to be able to see how they hold themselves, the equipment they wear, the uniforms they wear, how they wore their clothing, all of those give you an impression of the person. And then to be able to read their story and find out what their life was like before the war, what their war experience was like, and if they survived, how that was after. It's pretty powerful stuff. So this is, if we can go to the next slide. Photography, this could not have happened without this guy, Daguerre, building on the work of so many other scientists, chemists, artists, thinkers. He came up with the successful combination of chemicals and metal plates, and through his determination, in 1839 comes the first commercially successful photographic process, and it takes his name. It was 1839. So, next please. I think we can fairly say that the Civil War generation can also be called the photography generation. This is the first generation of Americans, and the world citizens for that matter, to grow up with photography. I like to think of it much as the internet. We're the internet generation. Think about how the internet has changed our lives. Well, photography did the same thing. We take it for granted today because I could take up my phone right now and take your picture. But gosh, back then, it was revolutionary. So if we can go to the next slide. Let's give you a bit of a sense. Abraham Lincoln was 30 when photography was invented. Frederick Douglass was 21. Clara Barton was 18. Ulysses S. Grant was 17. Your average Civil War soldier was 4 when photography was invented. I say the average age of the Civil War soldier in the North. And George Armstrong Custer was 1. I don't know if there's anything to do with it, but he probably had his picture, at least had the opportunity when he was an infant, a child, a younger man, and of course during the Civil War he went crazy with photography. How many images have you seen of Custer? He knew how to play to the camera, which was also a budding form that folks were discovering. So let's go to the next frame, please. All right, now I'm going to boil down 20 years of photographic history into one slide. So here we go. What I'm showing you here is 4 major forms of photography, starting in 1839 and ending up around 1861. And the photography, the photographic process, when it comes to the United States, what do here in America? We're technologists. We democratize things. We make them cheaper. We figure out ways to make it so that the masses can afford them. So photography is no different. It comes here and we go crazy. We go gangbusters with all of this stuff. So the daguerreotype comes here. It costs $2.50 to get a small one made. That's a lot of money in 1839, 1840, 1850. A lot of money. And you know why it's so expensive? Is because you have a plate of silver sandwiched against a plate of copper, two expensive metals, and then the chemicals on top to develop it, gold, silver, precious metals. So it's expensive. But in America, and also in Europe, in France, in Britain, they're also working on these problems too. The ambrotype comes along about 1850, and you've cut the price from $2.50 to about $1. And we've been able to do this because we throw out the expensive plates and we say, what if we just used a plate of glass? And we come up with some different chemicals that are cheaper that don't involve gold and silver, and we put some varnish on top, we put some black glass or a piece of black paper beneath it to make a nice little package so that their negative image becomes positive, and then you've got the ambrotype. Around that same time, other people are thinking, my gosh, glass is too expensive. Just take a piece of iron and let's get some cheaper chemicals. And it's called the melanotype or the ferrotype. But we know it today as the tintype. Very, very cheap. Now you've got it down to 50 cents. So on the eve of the Civil War comes yet a new format that brings the price way, way, way down. Not only does it now cost an average of 15 cents for a photograph, but because of this new process that's on a glass plate and chemicals, you can make multiple prints on paper. So I can now go, and it sounds crazy, but you can go to the photographer and get a dozen photographs made and hand them out to all your friends. You could never do that before. But now, on the eve of the Civil War, this has become a reality. Very exciting. So, next slide. So let's talk about this guy, Desdary. He's in France. He's the inventor, or he gets all the credit, for this card photograph that was also known by its original French name, the carte de visite. So, as the story goes, a French duke walks into Desdary's studio in Paris, and he pulls out his visiting card, which at the time, if you were somebody in Parisian society, you had a visiting card, which is about the size of a modern baseball card, and it was very, very beautiful, thick paper, and it had your name engraved on it, and you hand it out. It's like a business card today. And so the Duke comes into the studio, and he says, Mr. Desdary, as the story goes, can you please put my photograph on this card? I think it would be really interesting. So Desdary does as the Duke asks. I guess you can't say no to a Duke. So he puts the photograph on the card, and all of a sudden, it becomes all of the rage. If you live in Paris, you've got to have your photograph on the card. So Desdary, of course, has a great business. In fact, he becomes unbelievably wealthy. He invents a special camera with a number of lenses to make all these photographs. I like to think he's holding his head wondering, how am I going to spend all this cash? He's got it all. He's on top of his game. So here he is, sitting here. And so it spreads rapidly. The carte de visite goes to Europe and goes to England and just catches fire. Next. So by the time they're hitting England, Queen Victoria is going nuts. She's got hundreds of these cartes de visites are stacking up on tables. And no one really knows, what do you do with them when you've got hundreds? And for her, it's mostly her family, because they're all royalty. And so inventors think, well, let's create some sort of an album to put them in. So you've got the first Facebook, as I like to think of it. So next, please. Around maybe the late 1860, while Americans are preoccupied with the ripples from the John Brown event to all the secession talk and eventual secession that's happening, the little carte de visite quietly makes its way into the United States. It hits with a huge bang. People go nuts, just like they did in France, just like they did in England. And within a couple of years, it is gangbusters. In fact, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great American thinker and poet and writer, he's got something to say. He says, card portraits, it's another name for the card photograph or carte de visite. Card portraits, declares Holmes, as everybody knows, have become the social currency, the sentimental greenbacks of civilization. One story told to me by a photo historian was way out on the frontier. There was a little log house, and inside that log house was primitive furniture handmade by the occupants, a crude table, crude chairs, a crude bureau. And on top of that crude table was, again, hundreds of cartes de visite. Thousands of photographers start practicing the carte de visite. It's going all over the place. So interestingly enough for us, it's happening during the Civil War. So a lot of the photographs that are preserved today are cartes de visite. Next, please. You may be wondering, at least I was at one point, how many of these photographs were actually made? So I thought, let me try to figure this out. So I thought, let's just take the North, because most of the photographers were there. In the South, they dried up pretty quickly as the blockade came in and prevented a lot of goods from entering the Confederacy. So figure 2.5 million men served in the armies and the navy, and if each one sat for their carte de visite portrait, and then at some point during the war, some proportion sat again, and then some proportion of those who survived sat a third time. None of this is uncommon, by the way. You'd have about 39.4 million photographs. My count. Next, please. Now, let's figure 10% of those survive today. So you have roughly 4 million that are out there right now. So let's go find them. That's how I was feeling about it. I still am. And then next, please. Anybody go on eBay? Come on. All right, there you go. Anybody go on like once a week? Once a day? Twice a day? Hey, can we do it now? I'm addicted. I annually is my estimate, 18,250 per year. Civil War soldiers alone, I'm not counting politicians, I'm not counting generals, I'm not counting women and children, just the soldiers. That's how many a year. So, next, please. So here we are. The first photograph in the book to honor, I guess, some of the traditional, the early photographic forms, happens to be a tintype. And this came out of Baltimore, which is also nice because that's where I began my journey on this book. And here we have a tintype. It's really quite nicely tinted. It's actually a slightly larger tintype than the normal. Jerry, as he was known, Jerry Saunders, must have had a few extra dollars because he was being paid a regular salary for his time in the military. He posed with his wife, Emily Spott Saunders, both slaves who were freed during the war. And you'll notice it was tinted. That tinting, by the way, is not modern. That's not something that was done recently, and it's not a tinted copy of the photograph. The photographers at the time had the ability to add tinted color, and they would take oils, tinted oils, and they would apply a little brushwork there. Normally, and you'll see here, his Mr. Saunders, his buttons have been tinted gold, his waist belt buckle gold, his chevrons are blue. Of course, his wife's dress is red. So very nicely done. So next, please. A lot of photographs like Jeremiah Saunders came in. I found one photograph that maybe was in the possession of a family or a collector, one identified photograph. So there was a lot of searching to find them. Rarely did I come across a number of photographs all in one shot. There's one, really only one time that happened. And the reason is the person who's responsible for a single collection of photographs happens to be the man on the right, First Lieutenant Theodore Francis Wright of the 108th U.S. Colored Infantry. He was from Massachusetts. He was from a fairly well-off family, but not rich, fairly well-off. And they were very much into emancipation. And when their son, their parents' son, Theodore Francis Wright went to war, he decided to join a colored infantry regiment. So he was assigned to the 108th and made his way to Rock Island, which is a Confederate prisoner of war camp out in Illinois. And one day, he marched all of his men to the local photographer studio and had all their pictures taken. Thank you, Lieutenant Wright. Now, if that wasn't enough, if we can go to the next slide, here's what he does. On the back of each photo, he writes their name. Thank you again. He writes their company and their regiment. Thank you again. And as if that wasn't enough, he writes a little personal note about each soldier sharing some observation. And this one, it may be hard to read. Hunted through the swamps a week by his master before he reached a boat. Hyphen. Performed his duty well, not very smart. Now, anyone who made their way and evaded their master through a swamp, and I verified this, he turns up in Paducah, Kentucky, after a very dangerous 50-mile trek. I think he's pretty darn smart. We also see, there's some things to point out on this carte de visite as well. You'll see in the center the back mark. This is where the photographer, the engraved name of the photographer appears. You don't find it on all images of this period, but more often than not, the photographer's name is stamped on there. Hey, it's an advertisement for the studio, something you couldn't really do very well before in these hard plate images. Also, you'll see a 2-cent internal revenue stamp. Those were placed on photographs between September of 1864 and September of 1866. President Lincoln and later President Johnson realized that this war is expensive and they gotta pay for it. Photographs are popular. Let's put a tax on that. So, next please. So, I took a group from this photo album, which by the way happens to be at Yale University nowadays, and searched out across the country from as far up to Maine, down to Florida, out to Texas, Los Angeles, California, all over the place to find these images. They're in the hands of collectors. They're in the hands of families, museums, other personal and private collections. So this is just a sampling of some of the photographs that I found. So, okay, next please. All these guys are identified, which is something that was a part of my criteria. In order for me to research them, I have to know their names. So trying to find identified wartime images of men of color, that's time consuming. So I found these photographs, and then my primary resources at the National Archives are their military service records, and you'll see them on the top part of this frame. They include, there's always an envelope, which you'll see on the left. In the center are these monthly muster records. And it's basically an accounting of where was the soldier at the end of the month? Were they present or absent? If they're absent at some time during the month, you'll see a note on it. If they broke a drum, if they lost a canteen, they're going to be charged for it. You're going to read about it there. Those details are there. If they were promoted or received a furlough, you'll also find that information on the center card. Then there's another enclosure, which is the envelope on the right. Those envelopes include miscellaneous papers. Those miscellaneous papers could be a prisoner of war record. They could be a letter that the soldier wrote explaining why they wanted a furlough. It could be a casualty report. A number of letters and documents could be contained in there. So that's your military service record. You can drive to Washington right now, file a form, and get one within an hour, as long as you follow the rules. On the bottom is the pension file. Most of the soldiers or their widows, after the soldier died, if the widow survived, would file for a pension. These files are, they span from the moment that the application was filed to the death of the soldier or the widow. So in some cases, these files were closed in the 1950s and 60s. Some of them are actually still active because there is a son or a daughter of a Union veteran that's still, and I can't get access to the files because they're still not available. So inside these big brown envelopes you'll see on the bottom here, it's stuffed with papers. And those papers include everything. People complaining about their spouses, sons and daughters complaining about everything. There's also some amazing documents in there from comrades who served with the soldier. And they explain, I was next to Corporal Saunders when he was in battle. I saw him get shot. I helped him off the field. I gave him water from my canteen. Some very interesting details to be found in these records. One thing that I found interesting about the African-American records, the first one that I requested, and a number of requests afterwards, there were two big brown paper folders. And at first I thought that it was a mistake because I was accustomed to only receiving one for white soldiers. So I opened up the folders and I came to realize why. These men and their wives and their children often had no legal birth date, no legal marriage date, no legal anything. So what is the government to do? Because you have a man who claims, or a widow that says, my husband was in the army, but I have no way to prove it. I don't have any birth certificate. So the government sends out special investigators. And the special investigators are in Tennessee. They go to Mississippi. They go to Arkansas. They go to Iowa. They go out west. They go wherever the families have gone, and they interview people who knew the soldier, who knew the family. They meet with the former masters and mistresses, and some really compelling information as you read for my first time, I'm reading a document where a former master says, yeah, I own so-and-so. Or the soldier says, I was owned by so-and-so. Very stark, very high contrast, high relief, sheds a lot of light on that time period. So let's go to the next slide, please. So when I was really getting into this book and talking to individuals about it, I was met by skepticism that a book like this should really even be done. And one of the things that I was told over and over again is that black men didn't fight. They're pretty much support guys behind the scene, and your stories are going to be kind of boring. I did not believe that. I knew from all the work that I had done previously that that was not the case. Still, I was rather surprised. It spurred me on to find out just what these guys did do in the war. So with the little time that we have remaining, and then hopefully we can take some questions, I'm going to run through some portraits and just give you some very, very brief comments about each one. So we're ready to go. So one thing I encountered early on is the war for African Americans as soldiers begins kind of in late 1862, early 1863. What about all the men who wanted to maybe get into the war or in the war before emancipation? So I found photographs of men like Robert Holloway. He was actually never a soldier, but he was a manservant, an aide, there's a number of names, a body servant to this man, General Ambrose Everett Burnside. If you don't know a lot about the Civil War, Burnside, not the most successful of generals. I'm being kind. But you know him for the play on Burnside's, for his big hairy whiskers, sideburns. That's what comes down to us today. So back in 1850, when he was a young, recent West Point graduate in the territories out west, he somehow made the acquaintance of Robert Holloway. Holloway was somewhere in Virginia as a slave. I was never able to find out where, only a single reference to being from Virginia. Somehow he got out west, the two hooked up and remained together out west. And then when Burnside returns to his home in Rhode Island, a successful manufacturer of weapons, Holloway is with him. When the war begins, Burnside, West Point educated, he raises a regiment, comes down to Washington, participates in the first battle of Manassas. You all know it's a big rout for the Union troops. They all skedaddle pell-mell back to Washington. Burnside is one of the skedaddlers. He's back in Washington. Next day, he's writing all about his formal report. Holloway was not with him. Holloway got stuck on the battlefield. He was captured by the Confederates. They brought him to Richmond, and they made him a cook and various other duties for Union prisoners. Burnside writes a letter, writes two letters. Both of those letters wind up in the official records of the War of the Rebellion, a 150-volume set of all the correspondence of the war. We call it the OR today because it's hard, you don't want to say all those words. Two letters in there talking about negotiating his release. Burnside finally managed to trade the servants of five Confederate officers to get Holloway back. So it's an interesting conversation about a Union officer trading black men back into slavery to get his servant back. So the two do reunite, and they do stay together all the way until Holloway dies in 1876. They're back in Rhode Island at this time. And Holloway's son, Robbie, then becomes Burnside's servant until the general dies. They're buried near each other in Bristol, Rhode Island. And I found a wonderful account of a service, Memorial Day, Decoration Day. They read all the names of the men who had served in the Civil War. And in this little beautiful little book, they've got a list of all the names that they read, including Burnside's name, and they also read Holloway's name. So even though he wasn't a soldier, I think it suggests that the men thought of him as such. Next, please. You have guys like Silas Johnson. When the Union Army came into Vicksburg, the Vicksburg region, the Mississippi Delta, the plantation families began to flee. One family that Johnson was attached to, the woman of the house, the slave mistress, left, and she took her slaves with her, including Silas Johnson. The slave owner, the master, was in Virginia fighting, so he was far from Mississippi. So Johnson and the other slaves are with the slave master's wife, and they're displaced now, and they're moving into Mississippi and Alabama. And in Alabama, Johnson and one of his buddies realize well, we don't really need to do this anymore. They take off, they go to Louisiana, and they both join the army. We don't have the other guy's picture, but we have Silas's picture with the stars and stripes. Next, please. You have guys like James Monroe Trotter. Documentation says that he was one of the first to stand up and protest the not having equal pay. You may have seen this if you watched the movie Glory. The reality is that it was the 54th and the 55th that protested. The 55th, he was out there. His famous argument was, we will not degrade the name of an American soldier by accepting inferior pay. That was his argument. It took more than a year for the government to come around, and during that time, Trotter and all the other men in the regiment refused their pay. It hurt them, hurt their families, but they stood their ground, they got their pay, and as the story goes, he was the first one in the regiment to get his paycheck. Next, please. Octavius McFarland won a gold pen in a writing contest. His regiment was officered by men who were strong emancipationists, and they believed that the soldiers should be educated for the citizenship that they one day may have, and had a series of contests to train everyone how to learn to read and write. McFarland was one of the better students. Next, please. William Henry Scott, on the left, knew when he was 8 years old that he was someday going to flee slavery. That happened in 1862, here in Virginia. He wound up in the camp of the 12th Massachusetts Infantry. Loring William Muzzy, who was the quartermaster, more or less adopted him. His mom sent books from Massachusetts. Everyone in camp helped educate young William. It turns out that William and Loring hung together through the entire war, and as Muzzy was promoted from the regiment to the brigade to division level, and was at Gettysburg and Appomattox Courthouse, at Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, all the major battles, so was William Henry Scott. He was there for all of it. Saw more of the war than most men. Next. You may know the story of William Harvey Kearney. He was at Fort Wagner. He was standing next to Robert Gould Shaw holding the flags when they charged up the parapet. When Robert Gould Shaw fell, some of the men that were able to continued. Kearney was one of the ones that got to the top of the parapet. He describes what he saw. There was a volcano erupting all around him. It was dark, and the flames, sheets of flame and fire. He leaned down. He went down on one knee holding the flag. He just felt the intensity of the heat and the wind and the bullets. Miraculously, he was not wounded as the gun and the battle smoke was floating across the parapet. He looks out and he sees shadowy figures approaching, and he's hoping that it's his own men. And it turns out it's not. He realizes that they're Confederates and that the day is lost. So he goes back down the parapet. And on the way down, he's wounded at least twice by shell and by shot. Still, he makes his way down. A New York soldier helps him get back to what remains of his command, which at that time wasn't very much. But he makes it back with the stars and stripes. He gets back to camp, and the men see him, and they start cheering. And he says, "Boys, the old flag never touched the ground." And they start cheering again. And he tells that story, I can't tell you how many times, for the rest of his life. And he tells it slightly different, depending upon the audience. He's talking to Boy Scouts. He's talking to veterans groups. He's talking to folks, his post office friends. He worked for the post office after the war. He tells the story in a different way. So I was able to cobble together, I think, a very unique story based on all of those recollections. Next. John, or Jack Hines, as he liked to be called, he was a small guy. He wasn't even 5 feet tall. He took advantage of a little-known rule that came out of somewhere late 1862, and it basically said that a white regiment could enlist undercooks, as they were called, men of color, of African descent, as the story goes, to serve in the regiments. So he belonged to an all-white regiment, the 15th Pennsylvania Cavalry. He turns up at the Battle of Chickamauga. The positions are being overrun. As he's trying to get out, his horse falls on top of him. There's a moment when he is facing capture, and he somehow manages to get out from under the horse. And he's motivated because he knows, and he's an escaped slave. He ran away twice. If he's captured, he's facing death or return to slavery. He gets out, hobbles away, survives the war, and goes on to live his life. Next. John Peck was at the Battle of Olustee, where he received the first of his two battle wounds. Suffered a wound in the head, managed to recover and go back to his unit. Next, please. Taylor Aldrich was at the crater, among the last troops to come in. His colonel was out in front. His colonel jumped on top of a massive boulder that was blown out of the crater, was trying to lead the men on. They couldn't go down into the great crater. It was filled with masses of Union troops. You all have heard about the atrocities that were committed there after the battle was clearly over. He never got down into the crater. He tried to go around the side of the crater, but they couldn't do it. They were finally forced back. He was one of the fortunate ones. He was not injured. Next. Major Meekins, and his first name is Major, was one of the sergeants at New Market Heights during the Petersburg campaign. During this smaller part of a larger battle, all of the white officers in his company and surrounding companies were shot down during the fighting. No white officers were on the field. The men of color, including Meekins, stood up, took over, led the men, and went as far as they could. They didn't have the breakthrough that they hoped for, but all these men were recognized afterwards for standing up at that critical moment. Next. John Wesley Spence, he was one of the guys wounded at New Market Heights three times, artillery shells and bullets. He recovered a few months later and participated in the capture of Fort Fisher, which closed the last major Confederate port. It was in January of 1865. He survived. Next, please. William Wright was a slave in Kentucky. His master realized that the war was going to end and needed to get William to freedom. Escorted him to a rendezvous point in Kentucky, got him enlisted. 9 months later, William Wright was one of the first Union soldiers to walk into Richmond. The city was burning. Smoke was coming up. He was one of the first ones there. Next. Also there was this man, cavalryman, John Elliott, 5th Massachusetts. He and his regiment were in town. They were guarding stores, preventing looting, preventing fighting. Next. Anderson Ruffin Abbott was born in Canada. His parents were escaped slaves. He was college educated as a physician. When the war broke out, he didn't have to come. It wasn't really his war. But his parents were born in America. He came, made his way down to Washington, befriended Elizabeth Keckley, who was confidant of the First Lady. They hung out. On the night that the president was assassinated, the word went out looking for Mary Todd Lincoln was crying out to bring Elizabeth Keckley to her. A bunch of guards galloped around Washington trying to find her. One of those guards landed at his house. They went around, galloped around Washington on their horses trying to find her. They weren't able to do it. He finally went to bed about 2 o'clock in the morning, and about 7:22 or so, when the church bells began to ring, announcing the death of the president. He had lost really a friend because he had become friends not only with Elizabeth Keckley, but also with the president himself. And he went to pay his respects at the White House, and Mary Todd Lincoln gave him one of the shawls that the president liked to wear on chilly days. He had that as a token for his life, for the rest of his life. Next, please. Not all African Americans were in the Union. You had guys like Silas Chandler. If you just look at him, he looks every bit like a Confederate soldier. He's wearing the uniform, same uniform, carrying guns, knives, just like his master. Sitting next to him, Andrew Martin Chandler. A lot of chatter about this image on the internet showed up on Antiques Roadshow first. Later on, if we have time, you can ask me about how I came to make a scan of this photograph. Anyway, Chandler, Silas Chandler, was actually not a Confederate soldier. I found this out by going to the Mississippi State Archives and requesting a pension file for Andrew, hoping for some insights. And I was told that we also have a pension file for Silas. And I thought, maybe he was a Confederate soldier. And then I got the pension files. And the forms are different forms. Andrew, on the left, his form says pension for a Confederate soldier. Silas's file says pension for the servant to a Confederate soldier. So several of the Confederate states gave pensions to African Americans. Next. George Mitchell was at the end of a column of Union soldiers after they were defeated at a little tiny place in Texas called Palmetto Ranch. On the way back, the Confederates were harassing the Union column as they were trying to get back to their base. And his company made up the rear guard, so when the Confederates got too close, they fired back and pushed them back out of the way. It was said after the war, and I haven't heard anyone challenge this yet, that the last hostile shots of the war were fired by these guys at Palmetto Ranch. Somehow, it seems appropriate that happened. So I've got one more to share. This is Charles Singer. He was a barber. He was a free man from Kentucky, Covington. And in 1864, the summer, it was pretty clear that the Civil War was not going well. President Lincoln famously said he predicted he was not going to be reelected. The armies were stranded. Union armies were stranded in front of Richmond and Petersburg. They were stranded in front of Atlanta. It seemed like trouble. A lot of people were questioning whether or not they should continue or sue for peace. So Charles Singer, the barber from Covington, wrote an open letter. This was addressed to his comrades. Some excerpts from that letter that I think say a lot about the attitudes of the time, about African-American participation in the war. He says, these are all excerpts, "Remember, soldiers, we are fighting a great battle for the benefit not only of the country, but for ourselves and the whole of mankind. The eyes of the world are upon us, and on the result depends our future happiness. I hope that we may never see the day that we cannot speak for the cause of freedom. Why should we not cling with courage to this government, her interests, laws, and institutions? There are many reasons for so doing. It is not merely that I am grateful for the protection and citizenship that I may hope for, but I recognize in the stability of this government a source of strength to other nations. While this government stands, there is hope for the most abject, disabled, and helpless of mankind. Some say, show me what the colored man has to fight for, and then I will go. You cannot see it now, but wait until some future day, and it will unfold itself most gloriously to the whole country." Thank you. I ran over. I'm so sorry. I hope you all don't. We're not going anywhere else. Thank you. You had your hand up first.
Okay.
And therefore, you should go.
Held by descendants of these men in their families?
I do.
But the stories that families have about the men?
Mixed. That depends. There are some families that I met that do have the photographs and they do have the stories, but there are other families that have photographs but they don't know anything about the history, or they're learning about the history. So it really is a mixed bag.
Now, families have a lot of stories about the Civil War.
That's where you start. Yes, I completely agree. Start with the families. I do that as often as I can.
Yes, sir.
Yes, that was Silas Chandler, the slave, and I saw the photograph. A friend of mine out in California said, "You've got to watch the Roadshow. There's a Confederate image and an African American guy. You've got to have it in your book." I was like, "All right." So I watched it, and I emailed the program, and the guy who does the interviews, a gentleman named Wes Cowan, responded, and he said, "I can't give you the guy's email address, but if you, I'll send your email address to him." A few weeks later, I got an email from a descendant of Andrew Chandler, who was the white soldier on the left in the photograph, and turns out he lived close by me. So we got together for lunch, and I was going to, you know, help him to understand why he should share this image in his book. And I figured I had an hour of lunch to do this. We wound up talking for 3 hours. He's a great guy and was very on board with helping to get the story of the master and the slave in the book. At the end of the conversation, I said, "Well, I need to get a scan, a very nice digital scan of the photo." And he went to his briefcase and he pulled out a print that was made probably in the 1950s, and it was heavily retouched. And I said, "Well, thank you, but I really would like to get a scan of the original photograph that you had at the Roadshow." So he reaches into his briefcase, and he pulls out the original photograph, and he hands it to me. And he says, "I trust you. Do what you have to do, and get it back to me." Now, two things about that. It's the only photograph of its kind. The guy has only known me for a few hours. So here's the hardest part. Because I had watched the Roadshow, you know how the segment ends. They tell you what the insurance value is. I have to go from a restaurant in D.C. first on the metro and then go home. So I have a journey in front of me, and I have to carry this photograph home. And the insurance value is $30,000. I walked with my briefcase sort of like this. I did not move very quickly. I'm sure it wasn't at all obvious.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the study. I think it still makes our preferences better. Having a ship better today.
I agree. I completely agree. And a lot of the stories that are in the book are really, I think, the beginning of more of these stories coming out. I didn't write this book thinking that it was going to be a be-all and end-all. I have met people since then who have had new information to share, and if you go online right now and do a Google search, you'll see a ton of photographs. So since I started doing my work in 2008, and I didn't trigger this, it's just the time in our history, now that we're in the 150th celebration, it's a different time, and we're talking about different parts of the Civil War, and the African-American experience is really being talked about in earnest, I think, for the first time. Although the scholarship has been happening for probably 30 or 40 years now, if you want to track it back. But if you go back to the centennial of the Civil War, we weren't talking about African-Americans in the Civil War. So, yeah, sure. Two of the images are in my collection. They weren't before, but as I was searching for images and meeting some dealers along the way, I found two of the images, and I said, "I can't really afford to buy these. They're rather expensive, but I would like to just, can I just borrow them and make a scan?" And the answer was, "Well, no, we would prefer that you just bought them." So I had to do some soul searching, and now I have them, and I really don't know I need to do something with them, and I haven't decided quite what to do, but I like to make a donation with them. Yes, exactly. Other questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, it was a group of Pennsylvania coal miners. They were 48th Pennsylvania Infantry. Came up with what they thought was a novel idea, and that was to run a shaft underground that would go beneath the Confederate defenses, and they would dig, I forget how many feet, it was a lot, and put explosives, explode it, blow up a big section of the defenses, and potentially create a huge opening that the Union Army could go through. And we're in the summer of 1864, and it's obviously going to be a long fight to end this. Both sides know this is going to happen. So the order is given to proceed. They go about their business undetected by the Confederates, although there is evidence that they did know what was going on and sunk some countermines, but were not able to discover the actual shaft. On the morning of July 30th, 1864, the mine was exploded, and it created a huge gap in the Confederate trenches, sending men and artillery pieces all up in the air. Exactly. The Union troops, of which a lot of African Americans spearheading this advance, poured into the crater. They were poorly led. Burnside, who you saw earlier, happened to be one of the generals. There's a story about some of the ground level generals who were back in a hut drinking and didn't participate. The men go in. They get largely slaughtered. There are accounts that many men were killed, murdered by Confederate soldiers afterwards, and there's still a lot of scholarship to be done. It was not a particular focus of my book, so I don't have a lot of factual evidence to present on the topic, but there's been a lot of scholarship done and more to be done. Well, thank you all. I really appreciate it. I do.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.